Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is God's Gumshoe, and this is an investigation into the New Testament Bible. Today, we're continuing with our investigation into the story that the Gospels tell. We've already investigated the Gospels in the earlier episodes, and now we're investigating the story that they tell, which is the story of Jesus. And today we're beginning another section in that we're beginning to investigate the miracles of Jesus.
Throughout history, in times of distress, people have looked and longed for moments when the unthinkable could happen. For signs from God. For miracles.
It's what everyone wants. For diseases to be cured, for the powers of nature to be controlled, even death overcome. Stories that such prayers can be answered give us hope that God exists and that through Him such miracles are possible.
2,000 years ago, the belief in miracles was stronger than it is today. And one man in particular was renowned for being able to perform miraculous deeds. Jesus. He was said to have been able to raise people from the dead. Feed multitudes. And even walk on water.
Like every Muslim, I grew up knowing who Jesus was, not least because in Islam, Jesus is considered to be a prophet.
And in Judaism and Hinduism, he's regarded as one of the great moral teachers.
But Islam doesn't emphasize his miracles, because to do so would be to suggest that he is divine, something Muslims believe is unacceptable.
But this is, of course, exactly what the Christian church teaches. That Jesus was God's only son. He was divine. And his miracles go some way towards supporting it.
But is this just wishful thinking, or is it what Jesus himself really believed?
In this program, I'll be looking at whether it's possible to get into the mind of Jesus, to see who he really thought he was.
I've already discovered that to the people of the first century, Jesus' miracles were far more than just spectacular acts. They were subversive signs, giving vital clues to his identity. The Gospels claim the wonders he performed prompted the crowds to hail him as prophet, warrior king, and even Messiah. But in this program, I'm going to be looking at the miracles in a very different way. Not to find out who Jesus' contemporaries thought he was, but to try and understand who Jesus believed himself to be. I'm going back to the places he lived, and examining the Bible accounts of the miracles he's said to have performed to try and get inside his mind. I want to know, did Jesus really believe he was the Son of God?
The
The miracles of Jesus are amongst the best known and best loved stories in the world. Turning water into wine. Casting out demons. And calming a violent storm. And we know about these dramatic events because they were written down within 60 years of Jesus' death by the writers of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But we live in a rational age. We associate miracles with either medical advances or bizarre coincidences. And it makes us wary about biblical stories speaking of God intervening in the world. It is a nice idea, but surely it can't have happened like that. But whether we believe in miracles or not, Jesus' world of the first century was very different. For people then, miracles were part of the fabric of life. Medical technology was primitive, and for those who were sick, an act of God was often their only hope. Jesus lived here in the village of Capernaum on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and archaeologists have traced these very stones right back to that period. And if the Gospels are to be believed, they've borne witness to some extraordinary scenes, because it's here that Jesus is said to have performed nearly half of all his miracles. The Gospels contain records of over 35 miracles, and of these, the majority were healings of the lame, the deaf, and the blind. Archaeological evidence from the time reveals that mortality rates were high, especially amongst children. And scholars claim that on any given day, a quarter of the population was sick, disabled, or in need of medical attention. In a society like this, a healer was held in high esteem. Whatever really happened, however it happened, Jesus' friends and foes alike were in agreement. They believed Jesus was a miracle worker.
But it wasn't just his ability to do these things which so astonished them. After all, first century Palestine was full of magicians and wonder workers. What people questioned was the meaning of his miracles, and that's what I want to find out. If the miracles of Jesus were signs, then what were they saying to people in the first century? And can they answer a question so vital that people have lived and died for it for centuries? Who was Jesus?
So far in this series, I've discovered that through his miracles, Jesus was seen as a long-awaited savior. Some showed him as a prophet, like Moses, heralding a new age of peace and prosperity. Others revealed him as the Messiah, the mighty warrior who would set the Jews free from Roman occupation.
But in one particular miracle, there's a glimpse of a third possibility. That Jesus was someone far greater than either a Jewish holy man or even the Messiah.
That miracle is the first miracle, the so-called turning of the water into wine. Let's join the narrative here with this. Then we'll hear what our academic voice has to say, the scholarly perspective on what happened here with the choosing of the disciples and this miracle at the wedding in Cana.
Chapter 19, First Miracle. 3 days after Jesus called Philip to come and follow him, there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee that was being attended by Mary, the mother of Jesus. Jesus had also been invited, and his disciples were in attendance also. Before the marriage festivities were over, they ran out of wine. Mary came to Jesus and told him that they had no more wine. Jesus said to her, "Woman, what have I to do with you? My hour has not yet come." Note, many people have misunderstood this section of the story of Jesus and wondered why Jesus gave Mary the rebuke. The answer is instructive. Notice that Jesus did not call Mary his mother, but instead he called her woman, a term of courteous respect. Jesus was simply making the point that when it came to miracles, he was not acting under the authority of his mother and was not going to submit in the spirit of obedience. This mild rebuke of Mary was meant to point us to the fact that Jesus was operating under the authority of his Father in heaven, and that parental duties were subordinate to divine duties. Jesus made the same point with Mary when he was only 12 years old and stayed in Jerusalem to be about his Father's business in the temple. It seems obvious that Mary had more on her mind than just the gift of wine. She apparently wanted Jesus to manifest himself as the Messiah. His primary manifestation of himself as Messiah was the Passion. The time for his manifestation had not yet come. This helps you understand Jesus' response to Mary. But Mary said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you to do." Now there were 6 water pots of stone that the Jews used for ceremonial washing of hands before they ate. Each water pot held between 18 and 27 gallons of water. Jesus told the servants to fill the water pots. They filled them to the brim. Jesus then told the servants to fill a cup from the water pot and take it to the ruler of the feast. They did as Jesus said. When the ruler of the feast tasted the wine, not knowing where it came from, he called the bridegroom and said to him, "Usually the good wine is brought out first, and then after everyone has had a chance to drink it freely, then the poorer quality wine is brought out. But you have kept the good wine for last." This is the beginning of signs that Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and Jesus' disciples believed on him.
In the Gospel accounts, it was only after John the Baptist's execution by Herod Antipas that Jesus began his own ministry. He started wandering the villages and towns of Galilee, preaching his message to the people. He also gathered around him a group of followers, his disciples. He recruited them from among the ordinary people of Galilee, fishermen, farmers, workers, even tax collectors. Some were also women. Jesus also performed a series of acts that form one of the most contentious aspects of his life, a set of miraculous deeds that are still hotly debated today. Were these miracles actual historical events or just symbolic figurative acts?
Any modern person in a scientific world is going to ask, you know, are these miracles legit? Or are they rather really a case of early Christian myth-making, that early Christians admired and revered Jesus so much that eventually the stories about Jesus became magnified and he became this worker of great deeds? Well, your opinion on the question of whether miracles did happen or not is really a religious question. Either you believe that such things are possible, or you say, no, we know better, these aren't the kinds of things that happen, and you discredit them.
Dr. Greg Carey is an expert in the early followers of Jesus. He believes that Jesus' miracles have a sound basis in historical fact because he is convinced they were widely believed by the people at that time.
For the Bible, a miracle is something dramatically unusual that happens. So unusual and maybe beneficial or revelatory that people would interpret it as an act of God, some sort of divine intervention. The New Testament uses a couple of different words for miracle. uses dunamis, which simply means a powerful deed, a mighty accomplishment of some sort, and semeia, which indicates a sign, something that reveals something about Jesus' nature. On the one hand, there's their benefit for people, especially the healing miracles, but even occasionally a nature miracle, such as turning water into wine. But the other dimension of the miracles is that they reveal something about Jesus.
On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples.
We are on a hill with the ruins, of an ancient site. It's called, by the Arabs, Khirbet Gana. That's a very similar name to Cana. Cana from the New Testament, the place of the miracle of transferring the water to wine. And that's why it was identified by some scholars as the place of the miracle.
According to the gospel account of this famous miracle, a large wedding party was suddenly disrupted by the wine running out, and Jesus was asked by his mother to intervene.
People gathered from the nearby villages. Nazareth is just 3 miles away, 4 miles away from here, as crow flies. And people gathered from villages. This is why you have to do it for a few days, because people are coming from far away. And what reflects from the story in the Bible is simple life. So suddenly, the wine is finished.
The key part of the story occurred when Jesus told the servants to fill 6 stone jars with water and then to draw some out and take it to the master of the feast.
When the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew.
The Gospel of John, though, concludes the story not just by saying, oh, everyone says, wow, this is an amazing miracle, but by saying this was the first of Jesus' signs, and that the Gospel of John is trying to say is that Jesus has the power to bring vitality and abundance, that living water will flow within them because of Jesus. That alludes to biblical prophecies that wine would flow down the hills of Israel like water. There's a suggestion that Jesus is the one who brings life. That's a part of this miracle.
At the site of Khirbet Gana, archaeologists have found a cave that they believe was used by early Christian pilgrims who wanted to reenact the famous miracle of turning water into wine and somehow share in its life-giving benefits.
This was probably the beginning was a natural cave. But then when Christians identified this place, they took this cave and changed it, transferred it into a sacred place. What they did here is only some kind of a demonstration of the miracle itself, or to bring people in to see the exact place where the miracle really happened.
So they would have reenacted in some sort of ritual way the miracle, you think?
I assume so. This is a great example of what pilgrims are doing when they're coming to a holy site.
The miracle stories are an essential part of how the Gospels present Jesus and how early Christians understood Jesus. It's the case in the modern world that many people like to think of Jesus as a great moral teacher. But for the early Christians, it was just as important that Jesus could bring wholeness and wellness to people. The healings, for example, don't simply restore people to health, but they also restore people to their full place in society. They're no longer marginalized by their disability or by their uncleanness. The second reason these stories are essential, though, is that they're all revelatory. He's the bringer of life and the bringer of vitality, but the miracles often are interpreted in terms of stories from Israel's past, or interpreted in terms of the great deeds that God has performed with Israel.
This theme of abundance occurred throughout Jesus' miracles. The Gospels record 2 instances where he intervened to create miraculous catches of fish. The first occurred early in his ministry, when Jesus was calling his first disciples. He told some fishermen that if they went out into the deep water and cast their nets, they would land a huge catch of fish, so much so that it would fill their boats.
Now, the catch of fish is interesting because, of course, this is people's livelihood. It's a story that suggests not only that Peter and then James and John will be followers of Jesus, but also that their work will be effective and abundant in its success.
Greg Carey believes that because of a modern cynicism about miracles, many historians have downplayed their importance in Jesus' life story.
It used to be that scholars would rationalize the miracle stories of Jesus. For example, one scholar famously suggested that the story of Jesus walking on water involved an illusion, that Jesus was actually walking in a very shallow place, and the disciples just thought he was walking on water. And I think the reason that scholars interpreted miracles that way, of course, being modern people, rationalistic, being of a scientific age, is that they tended to regard ancient people as superstitious or naive. But the reality is the ancient people were suspicious of miracle stories themselves, and they knew when something truly unusual was happening. So chances are that what we really have with the stories of Jesus is that in his own time and place, he did have a reputation as a miracle worker.
Miracles and miracle makers were a regular part of life for first century Jews. The Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, is full of miraculous deeds that people would have been very familiar with during Jesus' lifetime.
Every revolution in religion has to look like a natural continuity. That's the way to do it. So that's why it was very important to present Jesus as one of the prophets. And if you look at the stories of Moses, for instance, Moses crosses the Sea of Reeds. Of course, Jesus doesn't have to split the waters. He can walk upon the water. That's one example. You have also stories about, of course, bringing people back to life. Elijah does it, Elisha does it, so of course Jesus will do the same thing.
Jesus' reputation as a miracle maker clearly grows through the Gospels. More than 35 of his miracles are detailed, and they frequently drew huge crowds. For first century Jews, Jesus' miracles were not only believable, they were a crucial part of being a successful rabbi and religious leader.
The way Jesus performs the miracles in the gospel stories is interpreted as a sign that he is God's agent. He speaks on his own initiative, and people respond and say, you know, what sort of man is this who's able to make the sea calm? What the Gospels are trying to communicate is that Jesus acts on his own initiative, that he is the agent of God's coming reign. There's a story that Matthew and Luke share that John the Baptist sends disciples to Jesus and say, are you the one who's to come, or should we be waiting for another? And Jesus responds by telling them, well, you know, the lame are walking, the blind are having their sight restored. That's the answer to the question, that in the coming of Jesus, the reign of God is breaking into the world, and it does so by bringing wholeness to people and communities.
According to the Gospels, Jesus was now established as a rabbi who could perform miracles and exorcisms. After John the Baptist's death, he had formed his own small movement and been revealed to his closest disciples as the Son of God. So now he could begin to spread his new teachings among the peoples of Galilee and Judea, a dangerous message that would soon bring him into direct conflict with the ruling power.
Now we'll call our third witness, or our third voice, in this case of the miracles of Jesus, to hear what it has to say about this particular event in Cana. Let's have a listen.
4. the wedding at Cana. By noon on Wednesday, almost 1,000 guests had arrived in Cana, more than 4 times the number bidden to the wedding feast. It was a Jewish custom to celebrate weddings on Wednesday, and the invitations had been sent abroad for the wedding 1 month previously. In the forenoon and early afternoon, it appeared more like a public reception for Jesus than a wedding. Everybody wanted to greet this near-famous Galilean, and he was most cordial to all, young and old, Jew and Gentile. And everybody rejoiced when Jesus consented to lead the preliminary wedding procession. Jesus was now thoroughly self-conscious regarding his human existence, his divine pre-existence, and the status of his combined or fused human and divine natures. With perfect poise, he could at one moment enact the human role or immediately assume the personality prerogatives of the divine nature. As the day wore on, Jesus became increasingly conscious that the people were expecting him to perform some wonder. More especially, he recognized that his family and his 6 disciple apostles were looking for him appropriately to announce his forthcoming kingdom by some startling and supernatural manifestation. Early in the afternoon, Mary summoned James, and together they made bold to approach Jesus to inquire if he would admit them to his confidence to the extent of informing them at what hour and at what point in connection with the wedding ceremonies he had planned to manifest himself as the supernatural one. No sooner had they spoken of these matters to Jesus than they saw they had aroused his characteristic indignation. He said only, "If you love me, then be willing to tarry with me while I wait upon the will of my Father who is in heaven." But the eloquence of his rebuke lay in the expression of his face. This move of his mother was a great disappointment to the human Jesus, and he was much sobered by his reaction to her suggestive proposal that he permit himself to indulge in some outward demonstration of his divinity. That was one of the very things he had decided not to do when so recently isolated in the hills. For several hours, Mary was much depressed. She said to James, "I cannot understand him. What can it all mean? Is there no end to his strange conduct?" James and Jude tried to comfort their mother, while Jesus withdrew for an hour's solitude. But he returned to the gathering and was once more light-hearted and joyous. The wedding proceeded with a hush of expectancy, but the entire ceremony was finished and not a move, not a word from the honored guest. Then it was whispered about that the carpenter and boat builder, announced by John as the deliverer, would show his hand during the evening festivities, perhaps at the wedding supper. But all expectance of such a demonstration was effectually removed from the minds of his 6 disciple apostles when he called them together just before the wedding supper and, in great earnestness, said, "Think not that I have come to this place to work some wonder for the gratification of the curious or for the conviction of those who doubt. Rather are we here to wait upon the will of our Father who is in heaven." But when Mary and the others saw him in consultation with his associates, they were fully persuaded in their own minds that something extraordinary was about to happen. And they all sat down to enjoy the wedding supper and the evening of festive good fellowship. The father of the bridegroom had provided plenty of wine for all the guests bidden to the marriage feast, but how was he to know that the marriage of his son was to become an event so closely associated with the expected manifestation of Jesus as the messianic deliverer? He was delighted to have the honor of numbering the celebrated Galilean among his guests, but before the wedding supper was over, the servants brought him the disconcerting news that the wine was running short. By the time the formal supper had ended and the guests were strolling about in the garden, the mother of the bridegroom confided to Mary that the supply of wine was exhausted. And Mary confidently said, "Have no worry, I will speak to my son, he will help us." And thus did she presume to speak, notwithstanding the rebuke of but a few hours before. Throughout a period of many years, Mary had always turned to Jesus for help in every crisis of their home life at Nazareth, so that it was only natural for her to think of him at this time. But this ambitious mother had still other motives for appealing to her eldest son on this occasion. As Jesus was standing alone in a corner of the garden, his mother approached him, saying, "My son, they have no wine." And Jesus answered, "My good woman, what have I to do with that?" Said Mary, "But I believe your hour has come. Cannot you help us?" Jesus replied, "Again, I declare that I have not come to do things in this wise. Why do you trouble me again with these matters?" And then, breaking down in tears, Mary entreated him, "But my son, I promised them that you would help us, won't you please do something for me? And then spoke Jesus, Woman, what have you to do with making such promises? See that you do it not again. We must in all things wait upon the will of the Father in heaven. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was crushed. She was stunned. As she stood there before him, motionless, with the tears streaming down her face, the human heart of Jesus was overcome with compassion for the woman who had borne him in the flesh, and bending forward, he laid his hand tenderly upon her head, saying, Now, now, Mother Mary, grieve not over my apparently hard sayings, for have I not many times told you that I have come only to do the will of my heavenly Father? Most gladly would I do what you ask of me, if it were a part of the Father's will. And Jesus stopped short. He hesitated. Mary seemed to sense that something was happening. Leaping up, she threw her arms around Jesus' neck, kissed him, and rushed off to the servants' quarters, saying, Whatever my son says, that do. But Jesus said nothing. He now realized that he had already said, or rather desirefully thought, too much. Mary was dancing with glee. She did not know how the wine would be produced, but she confidently believed that she had finally persuaded her firstborn son to assert his authority, to dare to step forth and claim his position and exhibit his messianic power. And because of the presence and association of certain universe powers and personalities, of which all those present were wholly ignorant, she was not to be disappointed. The wine Mary desired, and which Jesus, the God-man, humanly and sympathetically wished for, was forthcoming. Near at hand stood 6 water pots of stone filled with water, holding about 20 gallons apiece. This water was intended for subsequent use in the final purification ceremonies of the wedding celebration. The commotion of the servants about these huge stone vessels, under the busy direction of his mother, attracted Jesus' attention, and going over, he observed that they were drawing wine out of them by the pitcherful. It was gradually dawning upon Jesus what had happened. Of all persons present at the marriage feast of Cana, Jesus was the most surprised. Others had expected him to work a wonder, but that was just what he had purposed not to do. And then the Son of Man recalled the admonition of his personalized thought adjuster in the hill. He recounted how the adjuster had warned him about the inability of any power or personality to deprive him of the creator prerogative of independence of time. On this occasion, power transformers, midwayers, and all other required personalities were assembled near the water and other necessary elements, and in the face of the expressed wish of the universe creator sovereign, there was no escaping the instantaneous appearance of wine. And this occurrence was made doubly certain since the personalized adjuster had signified that the execution of the Son's desire was in no way a contravention of the Father's will. But this was in no sense a miracle. No law of nature was modified, abrogated, or even transcended. Nothing happened but the abrogation of time, in association with the celestial assembly of the chemical elements requisite for the elaboration of the wine. At Cana, on this occasion, the agents of the Creator made wine just as they do by the ordinary natural processes, except that they did it independently of time, and with the intervention of superhuman agencies in the matter of the space assembly of the necessary chemical ingredients. Furthermore, it was evident that the enactment of this so-called miracle was not contrary to the will of the Paradise Father, else it would not have transpired, since Jesus had already subjected himself in all things to the Father's will. When the servants drew this new wine and carried it to the best man, the ruler of the feast, and when he had tasted it, he called to the bridegroom, saying, It is the custom to set out first the good wine, and, when the guests have well drunk, to bring forth the inferior fruit of the vine. But you have kept the best of the wine until the last of the feast. Mary and the disciples of Jesus were greatly rejoiced at the supposed miracle which they thought Jesus had intentionally performed. But Jesus withdrew to a sheltered nook of the garden and engaged in serious thought for a few brief moments. He finally decided that the episode was beyond his personal control under the circumstances and, not being adverse to his Father's will, was inevitable. When he returned to the people, they regarded him with awe. They all believed in him as the Messiah. But Jesus was sorely perplexed, knowing that they believed in him only because of the unusual occurrence which they had just inadvertently beheld. Again, Jesus retired for a season to the housetop that he might think it all over. Jesus now fully comprehended that he must constantly be on guard, lest his indulgence of sympathy and pity become responsible for repeated episodes of this sort. Nevertheless, many similar events occurred before the Son of Man took final leave of his mortal life in the flesh.
Now, with the opening of Jesus' public ministry, he begins to choose his disciples. Then they go off to Cana, and the first miracle begins to take place. We've now heard the discussion from the biblical perspective and the scholastic perspective on the nature of miracles, and now the report from the Urantia papers. In studying the gospel miracles, one has to be impressed by the sheer number of events that the gospel books report, and by the fact that only a very small portion of these are related by the apostles in any detail. The gospels speak only of the most general terms of these miracles that Jesus performed in his great missionary journeys throughout Galilee and Judea, in Samaria, and Palestine, basically. We read in Matthew 4 that the people, seeing these things which he did, followed him in crowds. Luke tells us in Luke 9, to the number of 5,000, so that he could not enter cities, and his fame spread from Jerusalem through Syria. His reputation was so great that the chief priests at Jerusalem in council speak of him as the one who doth many miracles, according to John. And other disciples write in describing Jesus as the prophet, mighty in works and deeds before God and all the people. There were many witnesses to this. Luke, and both Luke 24 and Acts 10, in there Peter describes him to Cornelius as the wonder-working preacher. Something was taking place at this time. Out of the great mass of miraculous events that surrounded Jesus, each of the disciples made their own selection. And as John tells us, so many that it was impossible to narrate all of them. The word miracle means to wonder. In a general classical Latin, it means a wonderful thing. It relates to the feelings of amazement, the excitement of the occurrence that were produced in the material creation, appealing to the senses of whoever was in the area. But it must be remembered that in 1st century AD, everything good or bad was attributed to God, either as reward for good behavior or punishment for doing evil. Thus, even the miraculous in the Bible was through the works of divine grace and are above the power of nature and due to God alone. The wonder of the miracle is due to the fact that its cause is hidden and an effect is expected other than what actually takes place. Hence, by comparison with the ordinary course of things, a miracle is called extraordinary. So in analyzing the difference between the extraordinary character of the miracle and the ordinary course of nature, the disciples of Jesus, and theologians in generally, employ the terms above or contrary to or outside the then known category of nature. These terms express the manner in which the miracle is extraordinary. The miracle is said to be above nature when the effect produced is above the natural powers and forces of which the known laws of nature are normally expressed. A miracle is said to be contrary to nature when the effect produced is contrary to the natural course of things. Thus, the effect produced far exceeds the power of natural forces, or else it takes place instantaneously, without the means of any processes which nature employs, as illustrated in the multiplication of the loaves that we will get to by Jesus in John 6, and in the changing of the water into wine at Cana, as we just saw in John 2. The term miracle here implies the direct opposition of the effect actually produced to the natural causes at work, as imperfect understanding has given rise to much confusion in modern thought. Thus, the great philosopher Baruch Spinoza calls a miracle a violation of the order of nature as we presently understand it. So, for instance, imagine that we could go back to 1st century AD Palestine and carry with us an iPod, fully charged, of course. If we were to demonstrate this amazing 21st century tool, which is a modern fact of our technology to us, and demonstrate this to a first century person or people, they would naturally think that this was either a miracle and bow down to us or want much more from us, or that this was the work of some cosmic boogeyman, as they did with Jesus in Luke 11, verse 15, when they accused him of working with Beelzebub. We'll deal with Beelzebub when we do the Old Testament. But if we did this, they would surely stone us, just as they tried to more than once with Jesus and his disciples, and they actually did with Stephen. So the case of what is miraculous really is dependent upon the culture situation of the time. Again, the term contrary to nature does not mean unnatural in the sense of producing discord and confusion. The forces of nature differ in power, and we are in constant interaction with these forces, today even. This is true of our interaction with the mechanical, chemical, and biological forces all around us. So, also, at every moment of the day, I interfere with and I counteract with natural forces all about me. Scientists and students in high school study the properties of natural forces with a view to obtain conscious control by intelligent counteractions with one force with another. Intelligent counteraction marks progress in chemistry, physics, our understanding of the world, the invention of steam engine, aviation, airplanes, computers, and even in the prescription by our doctors. Man has learned to control nature, and in fact we can live only by the counteraction of these natural forces. Although this happens all the time, we never speak of natural forces being violated. These forces are still working after their kind, and no force is destroyed, neither is any law broken, nor does confusion result. The introduction of human will may bring about the displacement of physical forces, but no infraction of physical laws or processes takes place. It's quite obvious that Jesus had learned, or at least had a much more powerful set of mental tools than most that we still don't quite understand. And he told us that we too would do these things, one day, when we learn how, or when we advance in learning. So far, what we have done is that we've used this knowledge to make more powerful war machines, and it is sucking the resources out of this planet. Now, in a biblical miracle, God's action, relative to its bearing on natural forces, is analogous to the action of human personality. Thus, it is against the nature of iron to float. But the action of building a boat out of this same iron allows it to float on the surface of water, and it is not a violation or a transgression or an infraction of natural laws. Again, it's the nature of fire to burn, but there's nothing unnatural in erecting a dwelling that is absolutely fireproof. In these cases, there is no paralysis of natural forces, no consequent disorder. The extraordinary element in the miracle, an event apart from the ordinary course of things, enables us to understand the teaching of the theologians that says that the events, which ordinarily take place in the natural sequence of events, are supernatural events because we don't understand them, and they are the course of divine providence. But they are not miracles. Although they are beyond our understanding of natural forces, as we understand them presently, the creation of a soul, for instance, is not a miracle. For it takes place in the ordinary course of nature, but at a spiritual level. So, though we may not understand it, we may not understand it now. Spinoza taught that the term miracle should be understood with reference to the opinions of men, and that it means simply an event which we are unable to explain by other events familiar to our experience. John Locke, Immanuel Kant, so many others, agreed with him and held the same view. Thus, Professor Cooper wrote in the 1900s, "A miracle of one age becomes the ordinary workings of nature in the next." Hence, a miracle in effect never really happened in fact. It is only a name that we use to cover our ignorance of what actually happened at that time, with the knowledge and the enlightenment that we had at that time. Thus, Matthew Arnold, writes, "All biblical miracles will disappear eventually with the progress of science." The advocates of this theory assume that miracles are an appeal to the ignorance of the day, and with the discovery of new laws, we will understand these events eventually. And this seems to be one of the premises of this collection of papers called the Urantia Book. Now, the real problem of the historian and the investigator is to state these well-authenticated facts and give an explanation of the testimony as it's presented. The investigator needs to show how such events must have taken place and show how such a theory can explain them. He takes cognizance of all that is said about these events by competent witnesses, and from their testimony he draws the conclusion. To admit the facts and yet deny an explanation is to furnish no great evidence for their historical truth, and to show no qualities that are consistent with a scientific historian. So we must investigate these miracles of Jesus, and we do so as each arises within the flow of ideas emerging from our investigation of this New Testament Bible. We will deal with these each one by one. The great problem of modern theology is the place and value of miracles. In the opinion of certain writers, their antecedent improbability, which means they don't believe it, based on the universal reign of law, is so great that they don't really consider these worth any kind of consideration at all. Thus, his conviction of the uniformity of nature led David Hume, one of the great philosophers, and most atheists today, to deny the testimony of miracles in general, as it was led by his contemporaries of that day, to explain the miracles of Jesus on natural grounds. The fundamental principle, that is, whatever happens is natural, and what is not natural does not happen. The belief in the uniformity of nature is based on the profound conviction of the organic unity of the universe, the natural agencies of hereditary, environment, and necessary law rule the world of human life. It is the basic principle of modern science, and it cannot be ignored. But today, philosophy and true religion agree. It's the belief systems that still are mired in elements of magic and superstition that interfere in the true course of investigation into truth. But even these are changing, and they're changing rapidly. As an investigator, we need to investigate the testimony that is given. A miracle, like any natural event, is known either from personal observation or from the testimony of others. In a miracle, we have the fact itself as an external occurrence, and then its miraculous reporting. The miraculous character of the fact consists in this, that its nature and its surrounding circumstances are such of a kind that we are forced to admit natural forces alone, as presently understood it, could not have produced it, and the only rational explanation in those days was that it was the interference of divine agency. We need to investigate their testimony. However, the general rules governing the acceptance of testimony apply so much differently to miracles as well as to other facts of history. If we have certain evidence for a fact, we are bound to accept it, provided that the evidence is true and the reporting of it is true. The evidence for miracles, as the same for historical facts in general, depends on the knowledge and the veracity, the truthfulness of the narrators. They who testify to the occurrence of the event must know what they are talking about, and they must be telling the truth. The extraordinary nature of such miracles requires more complete and accurate investigation. But we are not free to reject such testimony. Otherwise, we must deny all of history whatsoever. We have no more rational warrant for rejecting miracles than for rejecting accounts of the Civil War, 9/11, stellar eclipses, or things that happen in our normal life that are reported to us by our friends and family. So, to those who deny miracles and have concentrated their efforts on the purpose of denying the historical evidence for miracles, and especially the evidence for the miracles of the Gospels, we must say this: something happened then, that we are only now knowledgeable enough to start to explain 2,000 years later, and with the discovery of a new form of science called quantum mechanics, and its new understanding of time and space. We're only just beginning to realize that. But as we heard in the report today, the Urantia book stated that Jesus did not have the ability to control time and the events happening within it. As a result, things happened that the Urantia book tell us of all the people there at the wedding at Cana, Jesus was the most surprised. He did not expect it. In 1908, the biblical world said that the old rigid system of natural laws is being broken up by modern science. There are many events which scientists recognize to be inexplicable by any known law, but this inability to furnish a scientific explanation is no reason for denying the existence of any event. If it is adequately attested, the testimony should be taken as true. Thus, the old a priori argument against miracles is gone. Thus, in modern thought, the question of the miracle is simply a question of a fact, occurrence, or event that we do not yet have a full explanation for. And this seems to be one of the premises of the Urantia book and its papers. Now, let us continue with the biblical perspective, or the biblical voice, in the continuing investigation of the miracles of Jesus. Here, we will now investigate three or four more of Jesus' miracles. We'll then listen to the second voice, or the academic perspective, and again, then the third voice in our case of the miracles of Jesus, the Urantia papers. Let's have a listen.
It was about this time that Herod, who was governor of Galilee, who had been reproved by John the Baptist for taking his brother's wife, and for all the other evil things that he did, sent soldiers to arrest John and put him into prison. After John was put into prison, and knowing that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself baptized no one, only his disciples baptized, Jesus left Judea and came into Galilee. Chapter 27. Arrival in Galilee. After 2 days in the Samaritan city of Sychar, Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit. He testified that a prophet does not have honor in his own country. When Jesus arrived in Galilee, he was received by the Galileans, who had seen all the things that he had done when he was last in Jerusalem at the feast. This is when Jesus began to preach the gospel of God. He also told the people that the time that had been prophesied about by all the prophets was being fulfilled, and the kingdom of God was at hand. Word of this spread throughout the entire region of Galilee, and he began to teach in their synagogues, receiving glory and honor from all. Chapter 29. Jesus' Temporary Residence. Jesus left Nazareth and made Capernaum his new headquarters. Capernaum is by the sea, within the borders of Zebulun and Naphtali. This fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah that said, "The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali by the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people that sat in darkness saw a great light, and to them that sat in the region and shadow of death, to them did light spring up." Chapter 30. Jesus calls four fishermen. As Jesus was walking along the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, fishing with nets in the sea. And Jesus said to them, "Come follow me, and I will make you fishers of men," and they followed Jesus. As Jesus went a little further, he saw two more brothers fishing, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. Both were in the fishing boats with their father Zebedee, mending their nets, and Jesus called to them. Great crowds had gathered around Jesus to hear him teach and preach the word of God, as he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret. Jesus saw a couple of empty boats near the shore. He got into one of the boats, which belonged to Simon, and asked him to shove the boat a little way from the shore. Jesus sat in the boat and began teaching the crowds from his seat in the boat. When Jesus was done teaching, he told Simon to get into the boat with his nets and head for the deeper waters to put down his nets to catch fish. Simon answered and said, "Master, we have worked hard all night and have been unable to catch any fish. But if you say so, I will put the nets down as you wish." As soon as Peter did as Jesus had requested and put down the nets, they were filled with a great multitude of fish. There were so many fish that the net started to tear. They called for their partners in a nearby boat to come and help them. They came and filled up both boats with so many fish that the boats began to sink. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell down at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." He was filled with amazement, as was everyone else that witnessed all the fish that filled the boats. James and John, sons of Zebedee, were partners with Simon in the fishing business. Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on you will catch men." And as soon as they got the boats to shore, they immediately left their nets and their boats and their father Zebedee and followed Jesus. Chapter 31, Healing a Demoniac. Jesus and the four fishermen whom he had called came down to the city of Capernaum, a city in Galilee. The next Sabbath, Jesus entered into the synagogue and began teaching, and those that were there were astonished at his teaching. For he taught them with authority, not like the scribes taught. While Jesus was teaching, a man with a wicked, unclean spirit entered the synagogue and cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Ah, what have we to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are. You're the Holy One of God." Jesus rebuked the demon and told him not to say any more, and he told him to come out of the man. The demon threw the man down on the ground and caused the man to have many convulsions and to cry with a loud voice. Then he came out of him, as Jesus had commanded, leaving him unhurt. And everyone was amazed, and they began to ask each other questions. "What is this? What is this new teaching? With authority and power he commands even the unclean spirits to come out, and they obey him." The news of this immediately spread. Rumors started concerning Jesus. Everywhere in the region of Galilee and all the outlying areas, they were talking about Jesus. Chapter 32, Healing Peter's Mother-in-Law. After Jesus had healed the demoniac, he left the synagogue and went into the house of Simon and Andrew. When they entered the house, he found that Simon's wife's mother was sick with a very high fever. All the members of the household immediately asked Jesus to heal her. So Jesus went to the sick woman and stood over her, rebuked the fever, and touched her hand. She immediately got up and the fever left her. Full of vigor, she began ministering to Jesus and his disciples. News of where Jesus was staying spread quickly. As the sun began to go down, people began to bring anyone that was sick or demon-possessed to Jesus to be healed, and he healed them all. This was a fulfillment of the prophecy in Isaiah that says, "He himself took on our infirmities, and he bare our diseases." And all the city was gathered outside of where Jesus was staying, and Jesus healed those that were sick with many kinds of diseases, and he cast out demons. The demons came out of their victims screaming and saying, "You are the Son of God." But Jesus rebuked them and commanded them not to speak or declare that he was the Christ. Chapter 33, Preaching Tour Through Galilee. Early the next morning, Jesus got up and left the home of Simon Peter and headed for a desert place where he prayed. Simon and those that were with him followed after Jesus and found him and said, "Everyone is looking for you." And Jesus said to them, "Let's go into the next town where I can preach, for this is my mission." The crowds looked for Jesus, and when they found him, they begged him not to leave their city. But Jesus said to them, "I must preach the good tidings of the kingdom of God to other cities also. This is why I was sent." Jesus went about all of Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, casting out demons and healing all their sicknesses and diseases. News of Jesus spread into all Syria, and they brought to Jesus all that were sick, suffering from all sorts of diseases, those tormented by demons, and the epileptic, and palsied, and he healed them. A great crowd gathered and followed Jesus from Galilee and Decapolis and Jerusalem and Judea and from beyond the Jordan. Chapter 34, Jesus Heals a Leper. While Jesus was in one of the cities, a man full of leprosy came to him, and when he saw Jesus, he cried out to him and knelt down in front of him and fell on his face and worshipped him and petitioned Jesus, saying, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." Jesus was moved with compassion and stretched out his hand and touched him. "I will," said Jesus. "You are made clean." And immediately the leprosy was gone and he was made clean. Jesus strictly told him, "Tell no man." Then Jesus went away, charging him not to say anything about what had happened, but to go to the priest and offer a sacrifice for cleansing, according to the law of Moses. The man left Jesus and immediately began telling everyone what had happened to him and spreading the news of his deliverance from leprosy. This caused much excitement, and great crowds came to hear Jesus and to be healed of their infirmities. The crowds became so large that Jesus could not openly enter into a city. So Jesus withdrew to a place in the desert where he prayed, and they came to find him there from every part of the country. Chapter 35. Jesus heals a paralytic. After a while, Jesus entered Capernaum and began teaching. The crowds discovered that Jesus was in a certain house. The crowds trying to get into the house were so great that there was no room for anyone to even squeeze through the door. Jesus was teaching them all the word of God. Pharisees and the doctors of the law had come from every village of Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem. Jesus was displaying the Lord's power, and many were being healed of all sorts of sickness and disease. Four men had carried a man in a bed that was sick of the palsy, but they couldn't reach Jesus because of all the crowds. So they carried the man up the stairs to the rooftop, where they uncovered the roof tiles and let the man down through the hole in the roof. They let him down right in the middle of the crowd where Jesus was teaching and healing. Jesus saw their faith and said to the man crippled by palsy, "Man, be of good cheer, your sins are forgiven." When certain of the scribes and Pharisees who were sitting near Jesus heard what Jesus said to the palsied, they began to reason in their minds and hearts and discuss among themselves what Jesus meant. "How can he say something like this? He is a blasphemer. Who is this person speaking blasphemies? Who can forgive sins? Only God can forgive a man's sins." Immediately, Jesus, knowing in his spirit the way they were reasoning and what they were saying, and knowing their very thoughts, answered them and said, "Why are you thinking evil thoughts in your heart? What is easier to say to the sick with the palsy, 'Your sins be forgiven you,' or to say, 'Stand up and take up your bed and walk'? But so that you will know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," he said to the man sick of the palsy, "Stand up and take your bed and go to your home." The man immediately stood up and took his bed and walked in front of everyone. He left for his house glorifying God. Everyone was amazed, and when the crowd saw what had happened, they were afraid. And then they were filled with excitement and began glorifying God who had given such authority to a man. They said, "We have never seen anything like the strange things we have seen today." And they were filled with fear.
Here now, the same events as recorded in the New Testament and reported from the Urantia Papers. Let's have a listen.
Paper 145. Four eventful days at Capernaum. Jesus and the apostles arrived in Capernaum the evening of Tuesday, January 13. As usual, they made their headquarters at the home of Zebedee in Bethsaida. Now that John the Baptist had been sent to his death, Jesus prepared to launch out in the first open and public preaching tour of Galilee. The news that Jesus had returned rapidly spread throughout the city, and early the next day, Mary, the mother of Jesus, hastened away, going over to Nazareth to visit her son Joseph. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, Jesus spent at the Zebedee house instructing his apostles preparatory to their first extensive public preaching tour. He also received and taught many earnest inquirers, both singly and in groups. Through Andrew, he arranged to speak in the synagogue on the coming Sabbath day. Late on Friday evening, Jesus' baby sister, Ruth, secretly paid him a visit. They spent almost an hour together in a boat anchored a short distance from the shore. No human being, save John Zebedee, ever knew of this visit, and he was admonished to tell no man. Ruth was the only member of Jesus' family who consistently and unwaveringly believed in the divinity of his earth mission from the times of her earliest spiritual consciousness right on down through his eventful ministry, death, resurrection, and ascension. And she finally passed on to the world beyond, never having doubted the supernatural character of her father brother's mission in the flesh. Baby Ruth was the chief comfort of Jesus as regards his earth family throughout the trying ordeal of his trial, rejection, and crucifixion. 1. The draft of fishes. On Friday morning of this same week, when Jesus was teaching by the seaside, the people crowded him so near the water's edge that he signaled to some fishermen occupying a nearby boat to come to his rescue. Entering the boat, he continued to teach the assembled multitude for more than 2 hours. This boat was named Simon. It was the former fishing vessel of Simon Peter and had been built by Jesus' own hand. On this particular morning, the boat was being used by David Zebedee and 2 associates who had just come in near shore from a fruitless night of fishing on the lake. They were cleaning and mending their nets when Jesus requested them to come to his assistance. After Jesus had finished teaching the people, he said to David, "As you were delayed by coming to my help, now let me work with you. Let us go fishing. Put out into yonder deep and let down your nets for a draught." But Simon, one of David's assistants, answered, "Master, it is useless. We toiled all night and took nothing. However, at your bidding, we will put out and let down the net." And Simon consented to follow Jesus' directions because of a gesture made by his master David. When they had proceeded to the place designated by Jesus, they let down their nets and enclosed such a multitude of fish that they feared the nets would break, so much so that they signaled to their associates on the shore to come to their assistance. When they had filled all 3 boats with fish, almost to sinking, this Simon fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, Master, for I am a sinful man." Simon and all who were concerned in this episode were amazed at the draught of fishes. From that day, David Zebedee, this Simon, and their associates forsook their nets and followed Jesus. But this was in no sense a miraculous draught of fishes. Jesus was a close student of nature. He was an experienced fisherman and knew the habits of the fish in the Sea of Galilee. On this occasion, he merely directed these men to the place where the fish were usually to be found at this time of day. But Jesus' followers always regarded this as a miracle. 2. Afternoon at the synagogue. The next Sabbath, at the afternoon service in the synagogue, Jesus preached his sermon on the will of the Father in heaven. In the morning, Simon Peter had preached on the kingdom. At the Thursday evening meeting of the synagogue, Andrew had taught, his subject being the new way. At this particular time, more people believed in Jesus in Capernaum than in any other one city on earth. As Jesus taught in the synagogue this Sabbath afternoon, according to custom, he took the first text from the law, reading from the book of Exodus. "And you shall serve the Lord your God, and he shall bless your bread and your water, and all sickness shall be taken away from you." He chose the second text from the prophets, reading from Isaiah, "Arise and shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Darkness may cover the earth, and gross darkness the people, but the Spirit of the Lord shall arise upon you, and the divine glory shall be seen with you. Even the Gentiles shall come to this light, and many great minds shall surrender to the brightness of this light." This sermon was an effort on Jesus' part to make clear the fact that religion is a personal experience. Among other things, the Master said, "You well know that, while a kind-hearted father loves his family as a whole, he so regards them as a group because of his strong affection for each individual member of that family. No longer must you approach the Father in heaven as a child of Israel, but as a child of God. As a group, you are indeed the children of Israel, but as individuals, each one of you is a child of God. I have come not to reveal the Father to the children of Israel, but rather to bring this knowledge of God and the revelation of his love and mercy to the individual believer as a genuine personal experience. The prophets have all taught you that Yahweh cares for his people, that God loves Israel. But I have come among you to proclaim a greater truth, one which many of the later prophets also grasped, that God loves you, every one of you, as individuals. All these generations have you had a national or racial religion. Now have I come to give you a personal religion. But even this is not a new idea. Many of the spiritually minded among you have known this truth, inasmuch as some of the prophets have so instructed you. Have you not read in the scriptures where the prophet Jeremiah says, "In those days they shall no more say, 'The fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge.' Every man shall die for his own iniquity. Every man who eats sour grapes, his teeth shall be set on edge. Behold, the day shall come when I will make a new covenant with my people, not according to the covenant which I made with their fathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, but according to the new way. I will even write my law in their hearts. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. In that day they shall not say, 'One man to his neighbor, do you know the Lord?' Nay, for they shall all know me personally, from the least to the greatest. Have you not read these promises? Do you not believe the scriptures? Do you not understand that the prophet's words are fulfilled in what you behold this very day? And did not Jeremiah exhort you to make religion an affair of the heart, to relate yourselves to God as individuals? Did not the prophet tell you that the God of heaven would search your individual hearts? And were you not warned that the natural human heart is deceitful above all things, and oftentimes desperately wicked? Have you not read also where Ezekiel taught even your fathers that religion must become a reality in your individual experiences? No more shall you use the proverb which says, 'The fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge.' As I live, says the Lord God, behold, all souls are mine. As the soul of the Father, so also the soul of the Son. Only the soul that sins shall die." And then Ezekiel foresaw even this day when he spoke in behalf of God, saying, "A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you. No more should you fear that God will punish a nation for the sin of an individual. Neither will the Father in heaven punish one of his believing children for the sins of a nation, albeit the individual member of any family must often suffer the material consequences of family mistakes and group transgressions. Do you not realize that the hope of a better nation or a better world is bound up in the progress and enlightenment of the individual?" Then the Master portrayed that the Father in heaven, after man discerns this spiritual freedom, wills that his children on earth should begin that eternal ascent of the paradise career, which consists in the creature's conscious response to the divine urge of the indwelling spirit to find the Creator, to know God, and to seek to become like Him. The apostles were greatly helped by this sermon. All of them realized more fully that the gospel of the kingdom is a message directed to the individual, not to the nation. Even though the people of Capernaum were familiar with Jesus' teaching, they were astonished at His sermon on this Sabbath day. He taught, indeed, as one having authority and not as the scribes. Just as Jesus finished speaking, a young man in the congregation who had been much agitated by his words was seized with a violent epileptic attack and loudly cried out. At the end of the seizure, when recovering consciousness, he spoke in a dreamy state, saying, "What have we to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? You are the Holy One of God. Have you come to destroy us?" Jesus bade the people be quiet, and taking the young man by the hand, said, "Come out of it," and he was immediately awakened. This young man was not possessed of an unclean spirit or demon. He was a victim of ordinary epilepsy, but he had been taught that his affliction was due to possession by an evil spirit. He believed this teaching and behaved accordingly in all that he thought or said concerning his ailment. The people all believed that such phenomena were directly caused by the presence of unclean spirits. Accordingly, they believed that Jesus had cast a demon out of this man. But Jesus did not at that time cure his epilepsy, Not until later on that day, after sundown, was this man really healed. Long after the day of Pentecost, the Apostle John, who was the last to write of Jesus' doings, avoided all reference to these so-called acts of casting out devils, and this he did in view of the fact that such cases of demon possession never occurred after Pentecost. As a result of this commonplace incident, the report was rapidly spread through Capernaum that Jesus had cast a demon out of a man and miraculously healed him in the synagogue at the conclusion of his afternoon sermon. The Sabbath was just the time for the rapid and effective spreading of such a startling rumor. This report was also carried to all the smaller settlements around Capernaum, and many of the people believed it. The cooking and the housework at the large Zebedee home, where Jesus and the 12 made their headquarters, was for the most part done by Simon Peter's wife and her mother. Peter's home was near that of Zebedee, and Jesus and his friends stopped there on the way from the synagogue because Peter's wife's mother had for several days been sick with chills and fever. Now it chanced that, at about the time Jesus stood over this sick woman, holding her hand, smoothing her brow, and speaking words of comfort and encouragement, the fever left her. Jesus had not yet had time to explain to his apostles that no miracle had been wrought at the synagogue, and with this incident so fresh and vivid in their minds, and recalling the water and the wine at Cana, they seized upon this coincidence as another miracle, and some of them rushed out to spread the news abroad throughout the city. Amatha, Peter's mother-in-law, was suffering from malarial fever. She was not miraculously healed by Jesus at this time. Not until several hours later, after sundown, was her cure effected in connection with the extraordinary event which occurred in the front yard of the Zebedee home. And these cases are typical of the manner in which a wonder-seeking generation and a miracle-minded people unfailingly seized upon all such coincidences as the pretext for proclaiming that another miracle had been wrought by Jesus. 3. The healing at sundown. By the time Jesus and his apostles had made ready to partake of their evening meal near the end of this eventful Sabbath day, all Capernaum and its environs were agog over these reputed miracles of healing, and all who were sick or afflicted began preparations to go to Jesus or to have themselves carried there by their friends just as soon as the sun went down. According to Jewish teaching, it was not permissible even to go in quest of health during the sacred hours of the Sabbath. Therefore, as soon as the sun sank beneath the horizon, scores of afflicted men, women, and children began to make their way toward the Zebedee home in Bethsaida. One man started out with his paralyzed daughter just as soon as the sun sank behind his neighbor's house. The whole day's events had set the stage for this extraordinary sundown scene. Even the text Jesus had used for his afternoon sermon had intimated that sickness should be banished, and he had spoken with such unprecedented power and authority. His message was so compelling. While he made no appeal to human authority, he did speak directly to the consciences and souls of men. Though he did not resort to logic, legal quibbles, or clever sayings, he did make a powerful, direct, clear, and personal appeal to the hearts of his hearer. That Sabbath was a great day in the earth life of Jesus, yes, in the life of a universe. To all local universe intents and purposes, the little Jewish city of Capernaum was the real capital of Nebadon. The handful of Jews in the Capernaum synagogue were not the only beings to hear that momentous closing statement of Jesus' sermon. Hate is the shadow of fear, revenge the mask of cowardice. Neither could his hearers forget his blessed words declaring, "Man is the son of God, not a child of the devil." Soon after the setting of the sun, as Jesus and the apostles still lingered about the supper table, Peter's wife heard voices in the front yard and, on going to the door, saw a large company of sick folks assembling, and that the road from Capernaum was crowded by those who were on their way to seek healing at Jesus' hand. On seeing this sight, she went at once and informed her husband, who told Jesus. When the master stepped out of the front entrance of Zebedee's house, his eyes met an array of stricken and afflicted humanity. he gazed upon almost 1,000 sick and ailing human beings. At least that was the number of persons gathered together before him. Not all present were afflicted. Some had come assisting their loved ones in this effort to secure healing. The sight of these afflicted mortals, men, women, and children, suffering in large measure as a result of the mistakes and misdeeds of his own trusted sons of universe administration, peculiarly touched the human heart of Jesus and challenged the divine mercy of this benevolent Creator Son. But Jesus well knew he could never build an enduring spiritual movement upon the foundation of purely material wonder. It had been his consistent policy to refrain from exhibiting his Creator prerogatives. Not since Cana had the supernatural or miraculous attended his teaching. Still, this afflicted multitude touched his sympathetic heart and mightily appealed to his understanding affection. A voice from the front yard exclaimed, "Master, speak the word, restore our health, heal our diseases, and save our souls." No sooner had these words been uttered than a vast retinue of seraphim, physical controllers, life carriers, and midwayers, such as always attended this incarnated creator of a universe, made themselves ready to act with creative power should their sovereign give the signal. This was one of those moments in the earth career of Jesus in which divine wisdom and human compassion were so interlocked in the judgment of the Son of Man that he sought refuge in appeal to his Father's will. When Peter implored the Master to heed their cry for help, Jesus, looking down upon the afflicted throng, answered, "I have come into the world to reveal the Father and establish his kingdom. For this purpose have I lived my life to this hour. If, therefore, it should be the will of him who sent me and not inconsistent with my dedication to the proclamation of the gospel of the kingdom of heaven, I would desire to see my children made whole and..." But the further words of Jesus were lost in the tumult. Jesus had passed the responsibility of this healing decision to the ruling of his Father. Evidently, the Father's will interposed no objection, for the words of the Master had scarcely been uttered when the assembly of celestial personalities serving under the command of Jesus' personalized thought adjuster was mightily astir. The vast retinue descended into the midst of this motley throng of afflicted mortals, and in a moment of time, 683 men, women, and children were made whole, were perfectly healed of all their physical diseases and other material disorders. Such a scene was never witnessed on earth before that day, nor since. And for those of us who were present to behold this creative wave of healing, it was indeed a thrilling spectacle. But of all the beings who were astonished at this sudden and unexpected outbreak of supernatural healing, Jesus was the most surprised. In a moment when his human interests and sympathies were focused upon the scene of suffering and affliction there spread out before him, he neglected to bear in his human mind the admonitory warnings of his personalized adjuster regarding the impossibility of limiting the time element of the creator prerogatives of a creator's son under certain conditions and in certain circumstances. Jesus desired to see these suffering mortals made whole if his Father's will would not thereby be violated. The personalized adjuster of Jesus instantly ruled that such an act of creative energy at that time would not transgress the will of the Paradise Father, and by such a decision, in view of Jesus' preceding expression of healing desire, the creative act was. What a Creator's Son desires and his Father wills is. Not in all of Jesus' subsequent earth life did another such en masse physical healing of mortals take place. As might have been expected, the fame of this sundown healing at Bethsaida in Capernaum spread throughout all Galilee and Judea and to the regions beyond. Once more were the fears of Herod aroused, and he sent watchers to report on the work and teachings of Jesus and to ascertain if he was the former carpenter of Nazareth, or John the Baptist risen from the dead. Chiefly because of this unintended demonstration of physical healing, henceforth, throughout the remainder of his earth career, Jesus became as much a physician as a preacher. True, he continued his teaching, but his personal work consisted mostly in ministering to the sick and the distressed, while his apostles did the work of public preaching and baptizing believers. But the majority of those who were recipients of supernatural or creative physical healing at this sundown demonstration of divine energy were not permanently spiritually benefited by this extraordinary manifestation of mercy. A small number were truly edified by this physical ministry, but the spiritual kingdom was not advanced in the hearts of men by this amazing eruption of timeless creative healing. The healing wonders which every now and then attended Jesus' mission on earth were not a part of his plan of proclaiming the kingdom. They were, incidentally, inherent in having on earth a divine being of well-nigh unlimited creator prerogatives in association with an unprecedented combination of divine mercy and human sympathy. But such so-called miracles gave Jesus much trouble in that they provided prejudice-raising publicity and afforded much unsought notoriety. 4. The evening after. Throughout the evening following this great outburst of healing, the rejoicing and happy throng overran Zebedee's home, and the apostles of Jesus were keyed up to the highest pitch of emotional enthusiasm. From a human standpoint, this was probably the greatest day of all the great days of their association with Jesus. At no time before or after did their hopes surge to such heights of confident expectation. Jesus had told them only a few days before, and when they were yet within the borders of Samaria, that the hour had come when the kingdom was to be proclaimed in power. And now their eyes had seen what they supposed was the fulfillment of that promise. They were thrilled by the vision of what was to come if this amazing manifestation of healing power was just the beginning. Their lingering doubts of Jesus' divinity were banished. They were literally intoxicated with the ecstasy of their bewildered enchantment. But when they sought for Jesus, they could not find him. The Master was much perturbed by what had happened. These men, women, and children who had been healed of diverse diseases lingered late into the evening, hoping for Jesus' return that they might thank him. The apostles could not understand the Master's conduct as the hours passed and he remained in seclusion. Their joy would have been full and perfect, but for his continued absence. When Jesus did return to their midst, the hour was late, and practically all of the beneficiaries of the healing episode had gone to their home. Jesus refused the congratulations and adoration of the 12 and the others who had lingered to greet him, only saying, "Rejoice not that my Father is powerful to heal the body, but rather that he is mighty to save the soul. Let us go to our rest, for tomorrow we must be about the Father's business." And again did 12 disappointed, perplexed, and heart-sorrowing men go to their rest. Few of them, except the twins, slept much that night. No sooner would the Master do something to cheer the souls and gladden the hearts of his apostles than he seemed immediately to dash their hopes in pieces and utterly to demolish the foundations of their courage and enthusiasm. As these bewildered fishermen looked into each other's eyes, there was but one thought. We cannot understand him. What does all this mean? 5. Early Sunday morning. Neither did Jesus sleep much that Saturday night. He realized that the world was filled with physical distress and overrun with material difficulties, and he contemplated the great danger of being compelled to devote so much of his time to the care of the sick and afflicted that his mission of establishing the spiritual kingdom in the hearts of men would be interfered with, or at least subordinated, to the ministry of things physical. Because of these and similar thoughts which occupied the mortal mind of Jesus during the night, he arose that Sunday morning long before daybreak and went all alone to one of his favorite places, for communion with the Father. The theme of Jesus' prayer on this early morning was for wisdom and judgment that he might not allow his human sympathy, joined with his divine mercy, to make such an appeal to him in the presence of mortal suffering that all of his time would be occupied with physical ministry to the neglect of the spiritual. Though he did not wish altogether to avoid ministering to the sick, he knew that he must also do the more important work of spiritual teaching and religious training. Jesus went out in the hills to pray so many times because there were no private rooms suitable for his personal devotions. Peter could not sleep that night. So, very early, shortly after Jesus had gone out to pray, he aroused James and John, and the three went to find their master. After more than an hour's search, they found Jesus and besought him to tell them the reason for his strange conduct. They desired to know why he appeared to be troubled by the mighty outpouring of the Spirit of healing when all the people were overjoyed, and his apostles so much rejoiced. For more than 4 hours, Jesus endeavored to explain to these three apostles what had happened. He taught them about what had transpired and explained the dangers of such manifestations. Jesus confided to them the reason for his coming forth to pray. He sought to make plain to his personal associates the real reasons why the kingdom of the Father could not be built upon wonder-working and physical healing, but they could not comprehend his teaching. Meanwhile, early Sunday morning, other crowds of afflicted souls and many curiosity seekers began to gather about the house of Zebedee. They clamored to see Jesus. Andrew and the apostles were so perplexed that while Simon Zelotes talked to the assembly, Andrew, with several of his associates, went to find Jesus. When Andrew had located Jesus in company with the three, he said, "Master, why do you leave us alone with the multitude? Behold, all men seek you. Never before have so many sought after your teaching. Even now the house is surrounded by those who have come from near and far because of your mighty works. Will you not return with us to minister to them?" When Jesus heard this, he answered, "Andrew, have I not taught you and these others that my mission on earth is the revelation of the Father, and my message the proclamation of the kingdom of heaven? How is it, then, that you would have me turn aside from my work for the gratification of the curious and for the satisfaction of those who seek for signs and wonders? Have we not been among these people all these months, and have they flocked in multitudes to hear the good news of the kingdom? Why have they now come to besiege us? Is it not because of the healing of their physical bodies rather than as a result of the reception of spiritual truth for the salvation of their soul? When men are attracted to us because of extraordinary manifestations, many of them come seeking not for truth and salvation, but rather in quest of healing for their physical ailments and to secure deliverance from their material difficulties. All this time I have been in Capernaum, and both in the synagogue and by the seaside have I proclaimed the good news of the kingdom to all who had ears to hear and hearts to receive the truth. It is not the will of my Father that I should return with you to cater to these curious ones and to become occupied with the ministry of things physical to the exclusion of the spiritual. I have ordained you to preach the gospel and minister to the sick, but I must not become engrossed in healing to the exclusion of my teaching. No, Andrew, I will not return with you. Go and tell the people to believe in that which we have taught them and to rejoice in the liberty of the sons of God and make ready for our departure for the other cities of Galilee, where the way has already been prepared for the preaching of the good tidings of the kingdom. It was for this purpose that I came forth from the Father. Go then and prepare for our immediate departure while I here await your return." When Jesus had spoken, Andrew and his fellow apostles sorrowfully made their way back to Zebedee's house, dismissed the assembled multitude, and quickly made ready for the journey as Jesus had directed. And so, on the afternoon of Sunday, January 18, A.D. 28, Jesus and the apostles started out upon their first really public and open preaching tour of the cities of Galilee. On this first tour, they preached the gospel of the kingdom in many cities, but they did not visit Nazareth. That Sunday afternoon, shortly after Jesus and his apostles had left for Rimmon, his brothers James and Jude came to see him, calling at Zebedee's house. About noon of that day, Jude had sought out his brother James and insisted that they go to Jesus. By the time James consented to go with Jude, Jesus had already departed. The apostles were loath to leave the great interest which had been aroused at Capernaum. Peter calculated that no less than 1,000 believers would have been baptized into the kingdom. Jesus listened to them patiently, but he would not consent to return. Silence prevailed for a season, and then Thomas addressed his fellow apostles, saying, "Let's go. The Master has spoken. No matter if we cannot fully comprehend the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, of one thing we are certain. We follow a teacher who seeks no glory for himself." And reluctantly they went forth to preach the good tidings in the cities of Galilee.
So please, join us again next week as we continue our investigation into the events that were occurring as that group were forming, getting to know each other, beginning to understand who Jesus was as best they could. We'd like to thank the Urantia Brook Fellowship and the Cosmic Citizen, and we invite you to listen to the Cosmic Citizen Saturdays at 10 a.m. Mountain Standard Time. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week. Please tell your friends. We'll talk to you again next week.